Okay, so what is this D3 thing then?
Right, well, it's basically this Comic-Con equivalent that they do over at Disney. And it's just started and it's showing off all the things that they now own, like Star Wars and, you know, all the Marvel franchises that they're going to be doing. The most amazing thing about everything to come out of D3 so far is that Disney are, like, creatively bankrupt. So they're doing...
Okay, well, you know, that at least has got the libel case out of the way early in the podcast.
Well, there's, like... There's remake after remake after remake. There's, like, a Jungle Book remake, which nobody needs. Like, there's nothing wrong with the original. There's a Beauty and the Beast remake, which is stupid anyway, because they've employed really hot actors like Emma Watson and Luke Evans.
It's a live-action version of...
Yeah. Which should be retitled to Beauty and the Beauty. What else have they got? They've got a new Alice in Wonderland sequel, because... the world needs another Alice in Wonderland Tim Burton movie. But everything is like a sequel, prequel, or reimagining.
But to be fair, most of Disney's sort of great things are rip-offs of previous things or adaptations of folk tales or what have you. Like The Lion King, which is probably the biggest Disney film in our lifetimes, apart from maybe Frozen, is basically based off of Hamlet. Yeah. So it's not that weird.
Yeah, but then you've got other things like... so they've got Toy Story 4 coming out. Where's that story going to go? They're all going to figure out that the new kid grows up as well. And it's like the existential crisis all over again. Like, are they going to try and reframe it because she's a girl and maybe the toys think, oh, girls don't actually grow up. And then they realise, wait, shit, they do.
Like, there's surely potential there for an examination of gender roles in our society.
Oh, but... Is Toy Story really going to go there?
Okay, so this is not actually the D3 podcast. It's the Right Dishonourable podcast. And as you probably figured out, again, I'm not here with John. I'm not here with Jazza. Sorry, I actually am here with John. Jazza is away this weekend at Summer in the City, which we referenced last weekend, which is actually another convention of YouTubers as opposed to Disney or whatever.
I'm sure they'd love to be at Disney making YouTube videos. That'll be the next thing, won't it? Like Disney YouTube videos.
There's probably already like a Disney YouTube channel somewhere, or a YouTuber who comments on Disney issues, if there are such things. But this week, we're not actually going to be talking about Disney. We're going to be talking about... what are we talking about? We're talking about what's happened in the Labour leadership election. The registration period for the Labour leadership has just closed. As a member of the Liberal Democrats, I'm not actually allowed to register in that, I don't think. But John, did you actually register to vote in the Labour leadership?
No, I didn't. I didn't know that you couldn't. Is that an actual solid... How do they check that, though? Do they check that against other party?
I don't actually know, because as far as I'm aware, there's not a national database of who belongs to which party. I haven't, allegedly, because there were these talks of entryism and stuff, there was a way of checking to make sure that, you know, naughty people were not entering the race just to vote for Corbyn. But more on that later. The second subject we're going to be talking about, John wrote an article on the Home Office's new mental health guidelines. So, John, what does that roughly entail?
So this week the government announced new guidelines for background checks, and as part of background checks, people who've been sectioned or had serious mental health crises, their details are going to be only released now if the police think it's really relevant to, you know, endangering people that they're going to work with. And I argued that actually this could end up being a huge backward step because it hasn't concentrated on getting rid of stigma. And actually the people who now do have their details disclosed by the police are going to be in an even worse position than they would have before, because now if somebody's details get disclosed by the police, it's going to be a real red flag of like, whoa, this person is literally insane.
Okay, so we will be discussing that as our second subject. And the third subject that we are going to cover is... actually based on Benedict Cumberbatch, the nerd's favourite. He's been studying in a production of Hamlet in the Barbican, I think it is. And he came out this week and said that he didn't appreciate some of his younger fans photographing him using their smartphones. So John actually has, you've got a background in theatre, haven't you? Maybe you should explain what it is you've actually done.
What I've actually done? I've done several, what many people would call unsuccessful productions. and some that have dubious success rates. I've been up to the Edinburgh Fringe. I'm nowadays like a writer by profession, so... But I used to dabble in acting and directing.
Anyway, we're going to be talking about how attitudes to the theatre are changing, and you know, these kind of celebrity productions that are put on, and we will be covering all of that after the intro music. So this week, the registration period for the Labour leadership election closed. So you now can no longer register to vote in the Labour leadership. And there's been a couple of polls that have come out in the week after, most of which, at least from what I've seen, suggest that Corbyn is on course to win. But there's been a couple of other interesting polls. There's one on by Servation that's on the ITV website that suggests that that Labour is actually more electable under Corbyn than he is under his rivals Andy Burnham, Liz Kendall and Yvette Cooper. There's also another survey that John, you've been looking at, and what does that say?
It's an independent leads with this article about a Comrades poll, independent on a Sunday, I should clarify, that the wider electorate thinks Corbyn stands the least chance of returning Labour to power. And actually, the Comrades poll showed that David Miliband would be the most likely.
So this is part of like the ongoing argument between the Blairite wing of the Labour Party and I guess what you call old left or the socialist wing of the Labour Party, which pretty much has been the main battle since Corbyn managed to sneak onto the ballot paper, despite everyone, including us, predicting that he wouldn't be able to do so. And obviously he's on course to win. John, what do you think, assuming that Corbyn wins, which is what seems to be the most likely scenario right now, what do you think it means for the Labour Party?
I mean, I've changed my position on this completely. I initially thought this was quite embarrassing that he had got onto the ballot, that he should have dropped out because he was sort of the old uncle of the party that nobody really wanted in there. The amount of support that he's got, though, I've found quite shocking. And in some ways, I don't see why that couldn't potentially translate to the electorate. I don't see why him offering such a strong alternative couldn't maybe gain him votes. That was a lot of people seemed to complain about in the last election. So maybe that would transfer well if he becomes a Labour leader.
I suppose the argument is that a lot of people that complain about politics have a greater interest and involvement in it than the wider electorate. If you're interested in politics, if you're listening to this podcast, or if you make a political podcast, you're in a very small minority of people who actually pay very close attention to politics. Is it not the case that this is more an internal left-wing Labour dispute that has got a bit out of hand and could actually make Labour far less likely to win seats in the next general election?
Is it though? Because I mean, I was watching, I've been keeping, you know, not close tabs on it, but I've been looking at things that have come out over the past few weeks, and he stays respectably quiet about all of the mud that is slung his way. And that is a very interesting quality in and of itself, because usually, you know, politicians get into heated debates across camps. Take it with, you know, the Republican leader debate at the moment. Everybody's trying to get a jab in at everybody else. Corbyn stayed remarkably quiet. Like, the few things that he seems to have said are things like, I don't really think, you know, other people should be getting involved. He did that indictment of Tony Blair as well.
Yeah, when Tony Blair came out and said that Corbyn would be a disaster like 2 weeks ago, he's now come out and said a very similar thing. And Corbyn said something about the Chilcot inquiry, that Blair should be more worried about that than worried about, say, what's happening with the Labour leadership election.
Which to me is just like a quite succinct put down. Like, nobody's really gonna, I don't see how you can demonise Corbyn for saying that, because yeah, everybody agrees that, like, that's what Tony Blair should be spending his time on.
But there have been questions about his associations with say anti-Israel groups such as, I'm going to forget their names, but there's been quite a lot of controversy over his relationship with Israel and his relationship by proxy. This always happens, and maybe is not fair, but with the Jewish community at large. And also there was a profile in the Sunday Times I saw today, which talked about his skepticism about what happened in Kosovo during the 90s and the numbers of people that were actually killed, and whether it qualified as a genocide. I'm not entirely sure of his position on that, but he's definitely more skeptical than other people, and more skeptical about, I guess, what you might term Western imperialism or Western militarism in foreign countries. But what seems to be the case is that no one does really dispute his integrity. He's, you know, in that old Tony Benn type phrase, he's a signpost rather than a weather vane. This is also where the criticism comes. Like, his views don't appear to have substantially changed in the last 30 years, or since as long as he's been involved in politics, which I think is more like 40 years. But do you think that his general platform is actually a viable future for Britain?
I mean, it's a difficult question, because I think a lot of it will hinge on whether he proves that his views can be at all malleable. If he gets into the Labour leadership and, as any sensible politician does, reviews his policies and goes, right, these are the ones I'm going to go forward with, these are the ones I'm going to keep as personal views. If he's sensible enough to do that, then yeah, I think he could actually prove he could prove to be a very hopeful leader for Labour, because he could return them to a lot of the values that a lot of people obviously want to see them return to as a viable alternative.
Well, one of the things he actually spoke about this week is Tony Blair very famously abolished what was known as Clause 4, which was Labour's commitment to public ownership. And he did that prior to the 97 election. I think it might have been in, I want to say, 94, 95 that he did that, but potentially not right, potentially too early. But Corbyn has said that he would actually reaffirm Labour's commitment to public ownership. So the most standout policy of this would be renationalising the railways, I suppose. Do you think that's a good idea?
A lot of people do. I can't say that I really have a personal stake in it. I mean, look, we all hear all the time about how we pay too much for our railways and they're not efficient or whatever. Will nationalising them make a difference? I don't know, personally, because I've never had any experience of a nationalised railway system.
Well, actually, it was at East Coast. It's actually quite complicated, because Network Rail owns all of the infrastructure. But then the actual train franchises are run by private companies. So you've got like Southern Rail, Capital Connect and so on. Would you actually vote for Corbyn, though? Because a lot of people, at least on the more liberal side of things and on the more conservative side of things, have said that they respect Corbyn, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they'd vote for him. So would you actually vote for Corbyn, bearing in mind that of, like, me, you and Jazzy, you're probably the most left-wing of all of us in kind of traditional terms?
That's quite surprising to hear.
I mean, aside from your outlandish reactionary views on, poor people and that sort of thing.
Bloody poor people. Would I vote for him? Because I did say that he was an old granddad a few weeks ago. Or what did I say? He was the embarrassing, dribbling old uncle.
Well, apparently he's 66 years old, so he's actually getting on a bit. And by the end of this parliament, he's going to be pushing 70, or on the other side of 70.
I'm really not sure whether I would. Because my inclination is to, like, this could be interesting. I want to see how it goes. I don't really know whether I could. I suppose that says something in itself. I'm not signed up right now. I'm kind of like, what happens when you get in? We'll see what, how you deal with it. I do think he could be an amazing opposition leader, because he will have such a viable platform as somebody who's going to be so passionately against what the Tories are doing.
I mean, the idea of him in Prime Minister's Questions going at it with David Cameron is way more interesting than Andy Burnham doing the same thing.
Oh my God, absolutely. Because, he'll be going for blood. Like, these are issues that he really heavily believes in. Andy Burnham, like, whatever you think of him, is a moderate guy. Like, when he comes out and talks about things, there's it says something that when I see him speak, what I notice most is his incredibly dark eyelashes and not what not what he's actually said.
Are you saying, you know, he's saying you don't notice Corbyn's amazing beard? I mean, it's actually quite an average beard, but he sort of works it quite well.
You know what I have noticed is he has this little, like, beat poet hat that he walks around with. It's quite incredible. For 2015, to be walking around with that is pretty cool.
And you can't see Corbyn, like, turning up in a really crisp suit and, like, you know, doing the sort of wanker banker thing, can you?
No, you definitely, like, he's going to be... he'll upset a lot of people in Parliament, I think, if he becomes a leader, which could be a really good thing.
Well, some of the Labour MPs have said that if Corbyn is elected, they will immediately take steps to actually fuck him over.
There's a committee, apparently, that Chuka Umunna and Tristan Hunt have set up.
Yeah, it's called the Resistance or something. You're crass like that.
Good or something. It's something really crass that basically says we're the better part of Labour. And they're like a resistance committee within Labour, which... I mean, sounds crazy, to be honest, but whatever.
Some people have suggested that Labour might have another SDP, as in Social Democratic Party style split. So in the 80s, there were some Labour MPs that when Labour was drifting to the left, they split off. They ended up actually allying themselves with the Liberal Party, as was thus creating the Liberal Democrat Party as it is today. Do you think, like, a similar thing could happen? There could be a rift within the Labour Party that's so large you actually end up with two different parties.
It would be very interesting for the Lib Dems if that happens, because they could gain a lot of members that way.
Well, I actually think that the Blairites and the Liberal Democrat platform is far more similar than the left-wing Labour and the Blairite platform. In a lot of ways, I think the only reason they've clung together, as in the two wings of the Labour Party, is because it gives them more power and it gives them more seats. It's actually been an act of mass cynicism rather than an actual, you know, principle thing. The other side of this whole equation, apart from the left-wing side, is what effect do you think this will have on the Tory party for the rest of this parliament?
Well, they'll have a stronger opposition, because at the moment, Harriet Harman's doing nothing. She's not doing nothing, but a lot of people are very unhappy with her and want her out as soon as possible.
To be fair, she's just an interim leader. She's not. She doesn't have a mandate. She's really just kind of, admittedly, she's not doing this exceptionally well. I think there was that whole rift over the welfare bill a while back. But yeah, I wouldn't blame her too much for what's going on now.
No. I don't blame her for anything. I think she's in a very difficult position. I just think in terms of, it's going to create a very different situation, isn't it, between her and whoever ends up being leader? Because or will it, though? Because I actually think that somebody like Andy Burnham or Yvette Cooper is maybe too moderate to be a decent challenge to the... We've got a government who are committed to 12 billion of cuts, which is a lot of cuts, and some of them are necessary, others aren't necessary, and you need a very strong opposition to point out concisely where it's going wrong and where it's going right.
And I think one thing that the Blairites probably do know, or maybe they should consider if they don't know, is that none of the Blairite candidates are actually that inspiring. Like, even aside from their policies, there's nobody who is like Tony Blair in the sense that they actually convince people that their program is one of hope and is one of change that can actually improve the country. It's more a begrudging, okay, we have to go and support these policies because otherwise we can't be elected. I know what you said about the opposition thing, but I think one thing that could happen out of the if Corbyn's voted in would be that the Tories might become quite complacent about their hold over power. They've only got a majority of like 11 MPs or something, so they've got 330 odd, or like, okay, they've got a slim majority in a House of Commons of 650.
332.
Yeah, that sounds about right. But what I think might potentially happen is that they'll the awkward squad, as they're known, which are basically the Eurosceptic Tories and the very conservative Tories who don't really like David Cameron because he, by Tory party standards, is quite moderate. They might decide that they want to rebel more often against him and cause more trouble. So I actually think that even though a lot of people have said that Corbyn would not provide an effective opposition because he can't unify the Labour Party, I also think that a damaged Labour Party might in the long term damage the Tory party over the course of this next parliament. Do you find that plausible?
Yeah, I do. Well, they've spoken quite openly, or several of their MPs have, on things like, you know, Question Time, Sunday Politics, etc., about how Jeremy Corbyn isn't considered a very viable leader. So yeah, it could create a massive complacency, because the thing that they still are very focused on is the fact that they're just relieved Chukwuemeka stepped down, which I think maybe some Labour people are sort of feeling as well. But I think you're right. I think it could create this sort of kind of vacuum space of, you know, due to the complacency that Labour could fill if they take advantage of it.
So the results of all this is actually going to be announced at Labour's conference in September. So we will know within the month who actually is going to lead the Labour Party for potentially the next 5 years, potentially less time than that, depending on who gets elected.
Prediction now, it's going to be Liz Kendall.
Controversial. If you've got any ideas about who's going to win the Labour election, who you want to win the Labour election, if you're actually a Labour voter, because we seem not to have any of those on the Right Dishonourable staff at the moment, do get in touch. Get in touch via Twitter at Right Dishonour, rightdishonourable.com, and also via iTunes as well. And at some point we will set up the other social media accounts, as we promise every week and fail to do every week. So this week, the Home Office released new guidance around what mental health history can be disclosed in records checks when people are working in public sector roles involving vulnerable people. John wrote a piece for the site discussing what he thinks the effect of this is. And so I'm just going to sort of hand it over to him, and so he can explain, like, why do you feel that these guidelines, even though superficially they seem appealing, are not such a good idea?
Right, so the Home Office have just handed new guidelines to the Disclosure and Barring Service, which the general effect of which is to make it less likely that the police disclose mental health information to potential employers. So basically what I argued in the piece is that whilst this seems to be like a good idea, and Paul Farmer, who's the CEO of Mind, has supported this, it's actually a backward step, because what it does is create a society in which secrecy is encouraged and openness is not.
So you actually mentioned Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which was a US military policy in which homosexuality was somewhat tolerated within the American armed forces, but you weren't allowed to really disclose or talk about it, hence Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So you could join the American army as a gay man or a lesbian woman or what have you, and you could serve, but you weren't allowed to openly be gay or express your sexuality in that sense. So I guess the comparison that you drew in that article is that these laws are kind of create, like, in reinforcing an existing stigma around mental illness. How bad exactly do you think the stigma of mental illness in employment is right now?
Well, it's supposedly the stigma affects 9 out of 10 people with mental health issues, which is astonishing, really, when you think about these are vulnerable people who have illnesses and disabilities. And 90% of them feel that they come into contact with discrimination and stigma. And it's against the law, but has only recently been made. The Equality Act covering mental health was 2010, I believe. So that's 5 years. If you compare it with equality for sexism in employment and things like that, we're 40 years down the line and it's still not completely solved. Some people would argue it's still not at all solved. And, you know, anyway, that's its own argument. My point being that there's no reason why, if that took 40 years, this isn't going to take 40 years to come into effect. As a person with mental health issues, I don't feel I can disclose on a CV that I get worried. I mean, I'm in a difficult position because I've spoken to papers like The Guardian about it. So if somebody Googles my name and their prejudice, I am fucked.
But as an employer, do you not think it's somewhat valid to assume, all other things being equal, if you assume that you have two candidates who are identical in qualification and skill level and appropriateness for the job, if one of them has, say, chronic depression and the other one doesn't, isn't the one without chronic depression a better candidate for the job?
No, not really. I think, no, not at all. I don't think it affects your ability to do a job. I think it affects, I mean, you know, like you take most of the people I've known, you take their condition, it affects things like their friendship circles. They'll go through periods where they're not really talking to people or they're not eating. It affects their physical health and things like that, but it doesn't necessarily affect their work at all. Some people are remarkable at actually ploughing what little energy they have into doing something like a job because they get the whole sort of reward centre of the brain. You know, they've done an article at the end of the day or they did their finance report or whatever. So it helps sort of balance them out because they have something to do. So I don't think it affects your ability to work at all. If anything, it can be a very good motivator for you to concentrate more on work.
So what would, if you were Prime Minister, what would you actually do to actually combat what you see as the stigma against mentally ill people when it comes to employment?
I'd encourage openness. I don't see why we've opted to go for this, let's make it easier for people to keep this private. Because the other thing it does is it's going to demonise the people whose details do get disclosed by the background check service.
I'm not sure you mentioned this before, but if somebody has quite an extreme history of mental illness, their details can still be disclosed to the employer.
Yeah, sorry. So basically, what has happened as a result of these guidelines is that the worse your mental health crisis is, or the worse your situation has been in terms of repeated crises, the more likely you are now are to have it disclosed, which means that you're the only people basically who are going to have it disclosed. If you just have it, the guidelines explicitly say in and of itself, you know, being sectioned or having a mental health crisis, etc., does not equate to this information can be given over. So now the people who are going to have like red flags next to their names are the people who are the most vulnerable, and they're the people that probably need the most help. And I think people like that, we shouldn't be deterring people who've had serious mental health crises from trying to get back into work. And that's essentially what we're trying to do, because if you want to apply for a job after you've been through all this kind of stuff, you're trying to, you know, get your life back on track. You've obviously gone through some horrible things, and you want to lead a more quote unquote normal, happy, healthy life. And we're preventing that through these guidelines, and we're preventing that through this reinforcing this culture of secrecy. Mental health is something you don't discriminate against people who break their leg. You don't look at somebody who's broken their leg and feel anything but sympathy for them, really, because you think, oh, that's pretty crap. They've got to have a leg in a cast for a few weeks. Must be pretty hard to get around on the train or whatever. Because we can't see mental illnesses, we look at them as something very different. We look at them as something scary. You know, there are people who genuinely think you can catch depression just by being around a depressed person. There's a lot of ignorance out there.
So, but from the point of view of the guardians and families and parents of some of the vulnerable people that these public services who the mental health records apply to, is there not any validity to their concerns that their children or whatever will be, you know, exposed to people who have had serious health and mental health problems in the past?
There is and there isn't. If people are delusional to the point where they can be a danger to other people, obviously that's concerning. But at the same time, if somebody has suffered from delusions then is put on medication and has never suffered from delusions since, are we just going to demonize this person for the rest of their lives because they've got a chemical imbalance in their brain? You've got to look at these things very, very contextually, and this advice isn't specific enough to look at those kind of things contextually and, you know, prevent people being really demonized if they have serious problems.
So are there no jobs, even outside the ones that this legislation applies to, that you would actually think, no, somebody with a history of mental health problems should not be able to do that job, full stop?
There are certain things. For example, you can't get a job in a pharmacy if you've had a mental health problem, because the worry is that you'll nick drugs and hurt yourself.
Is that fair from your point of view?
Yeah, absolutely fair, because it's true. You know, if you're somebody who has depression, if depression comes back while you're working in that kind of job, there's a lot of dangerous stuff around you that you could use to hurt yourself. So yeah, jobs like that, I think it's a protection of yourself. But I think this, you know, this like demonizing idea of mental health people, mental health, basically, if you have a mental health issue, you're far more likely to be hurt by somebody else discriminating against you. And I mean that physically, not just emotionally, than you are to actually hurt somebody else. And that's backed up by several different studies. So I don't think we should have this paranoia that mental health sufferers are going to go around hurting people, because it's just not true.
So based on this legislation and the kind of general state of mental health action, I guess you could say, from the government and from the third sector, what do you think is the prospect for mental health in the UK over the next parliament?
Well, apparently they're quite committed to it. There was a Huffington Post article this week by Paul Farmer that said, it said a lot of interesting things about, you know, commitments made by MPs, etc. Whether those will be, you know, whether they'll still have sort of borne out in the next 5 years, we'll have to see. I'm very sceptical. It's promising, but in terms of social attitudes, we've still got an awful lot of problems. I don't see it being solved anytime soon. I don't see stigmas being solved anytime soon. And I see things like this as a real step backwards.
All right, so I think that's probably that subject is covered as fully as we can. But I'm sure that some of you listening will have thoughts on what the government's doing around mental health, this legislation in particular, and more generally. So, you know, if you want to send something in, you can do it via the usual chat channels, Twitter at @rightdishonourable, rightdishonourable.com, and via iTunes as well. And we'll look forward to hearing your thoughts. So this week, the actor Benedict Cumberbatch, who is currently starring in a Barbican production of Hamlet, the Shakespeare play, decided to stop a performance halfway through, just when he was about to deliver the famous "to be or not to be" soliloquy that is just about the only bit of Hamlet that anyone actually remembers, because he could see smartphones and cameras in the audience that were filming him, and he found it distracting. And he later went outside and spoke to some of the audience members who were standing there filming this whole exchange on their smartphones, to try and plead and remonstrate with them to not film using their smartphones when they were watching a play. And I think this is just a fascinating episode, purely because of the kind of change, the way technology is kind of changing the way we interact with old forms of art, and the kind of resistance to that, and maybe the way that technology is also spoiling our appreciation of art. But as I said earlier, John is actually a playwright. He's actually put on productions himself. What do you make of this whole episode and this whole argument?
I mean, I could understand if it was somebody answering their phone in the auditorium, because, yeah, that really puts you off and people have sort of stopped plays. I never think you should stop a play for those kind of things. I think the shame falls on the person who's done it. If you want to not say any lines until they leave or something, fine. Obviously, if it gets a bit extreme, yeah, maybe you do feel the need to break character. the whole idea is that it's part of the illusion. So don't, like, number one point, don't break character.
But it sounds like it wasn't as though someone was making a noise or really distracting the audience. They were just distracting. There was just a red light in the audience by the sounds of it.
Yeah, this is what I wanted to get onto. Secondly, so he's started this soliloquy again, supposedly, just because he's caught a red light out of the corner of his eye. This is a guy who's been in films where he's got multi-camera angles and people running around with, like, microphones and lights and whatever. And he's had to start every take again, sometimes, like when somebody's moved or a lighting's been slightly adjusted. Bollocks. There is no fucking way that on, like, the set of The Intimidation Game or something, every time a crew member moved, he went, no, sorry. Sorry, I need to start again. I was distracted. What? No, I think this is a cover-up for a blunder. Because it's the theatre's responsibility. Like, anybody who's ever worked in theatre knows that it's the theatre's responsibility to get rid of the phones anyway.
So when you say a blunder, what do you mean by that?
I think he'd fucked up the speech and then went back and decided, right, how do I explain this? There was a phone in the audience.
I mean, is it possible he fucked up the speech because of the camera and then decided to restart it and then felt he had to justify restarting it?
Right, you know? The only reason that he would have fucked up the speech because he noticed, as in his own words, a red light in the crowd, is because he's not concentrating enough on the speech. if your concentration on that soliloquy is insufficient enough that you go, there's a red dot in that audience, then yeah, you're gonna fuck up because you fucked up by virtue of thinking about it.
I mean, whenever there are these discussions about the poshness of theatre goers these days, people always say that in the past the oiks and the plebs used to go down to, like, Shakespeare's theatre, and then they would chat during the performance and they would drink and they would eat fuck around, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like back in the days of Shakespeare, I mean, the Globe Theatre was more like a brothel than anything else. If you were a groundling, you could throw shit at the actors. Like, legitimately, if you got pissed off with their performance, it was quite common for people to just be like, I have a rotten tomato here, fuck you.
So does this show the extent to which, I guess, you know, the theatre's been gentrified now?
I have a real problem with theatre on many levels in terms of this kind of stuff, because it's like there's that service Digital Theatre, which I think is great. It's like a rental service for plays that have been on. Not nearly enough plays get put on it, though. Because, in terms of our country, most plays get put on in London. If you live in fucking Newcastle, you're not coming all the way down to London just to see Benedict Cumberbatch in a play. Put it on rental on a streaming service or something. And yet, like, you have National Theatre Live and shit like that. Not nearly in enough cinemas. Not available at home. Like, who's going to go to the cinema to watch theatre? You're asking somebody to pay like £20 for a ticket to go watch National Theatre Live at a shitty Odeon that smells of popcorn. You would much rather pay like £10-12 to watch it at home on your TV or whatever, or on your phone or something like that. You don't want to fucking watch it in
So even accusations of unprofessionalism aside, do you think that Cumberbatch has a point?
What about people?
About people watching, like, going to live concerts or live theatre productions or whatever, and spending, like, a portion of the performance watching it through their phones?
I mean, some people argue... So there's one thing that you should never do, which is take flash photo. I mean, technically, you shouldn't take photos at all, but you're an absolute dick if you're taking flash photography during a performance, because... I don't know, you could give the actor an epileptic fit, which would really ruin the whole thing. But what do they expect? If you've paid fucking 50 quid for a ticket, you want to take pictures because you want to remember it. And the DVD's not going to come out in a few months.
But I wonder if there's a lot of talk in technology circles about the effect that, say, Google is having on our memories, and the fact that we keep all of our phone contacts now on a SIM card or on our phone memory or whatever, and we never actually remember quite a lot of things now. We rely on technology as a kind of external memory. And I wonder if people maybe shouldn't be so focused on having photos and digital recordings of things, and maybe should just be satisfied with the memory of a good evening and not worry too much about the rest of it.
Absolutely. I think you're correct. That thing, Jack White went a bit nuts. Was it last year or something at Lollapalooza and said, everybody put their fucking phones down now or whatever. And people were like, oh, you know, Jack White's had a meltdown, like a Kanye West-style meltdown. And you look into it and you're like, no, not really. He just said, can you please watch me, not watch me through your phone. That's weird.
Yeah,
I think you should be present in the moment. I also think theatre is far too exclusive and doesn't have enough sort of cheaper alternative venues through which to watch it. Not everybody's going to make it down to London. Not everybody can afford the tickets. Put it up for rental on sites like Digital Theatre. Release DVDs of it, whatever. There's not a rights issue, is there, with Hamlet? Like, Shakespeare's dead, so...
But the other side of this is that it's quite difficult from a financial point of view to actually put on these productions. A lot of these things are quite... They exist on a... On very small margins. They often don't make a profit. It's often quite difficult to actually get them travelling around the country. So what would you say to people who make those objections?
That is very true of small productions. It's very hard to do small productions in this country. If you've got Benedict Cumberbatch at the Barbican, that is not a problem. They have literally no excuse. I don't know what he expects, because this is it was sold out very early. It's a limited run. There's no promise of like a DVD for the people who couldn't make it. And I think theatres get scared that, you know, if they say there's going to be a DVD, nobody's going to bother going to the theatre. No, if you're the kind of person who's going to bother going to the theatre in the first place, you're still going to fucking go to the theatre. If you sold the DVD, you're going to make even more money and more people can see it. That's why some of these people are filming it, because, you know, let's say hypothetically you're from Edinburgh and you're the lucky one of your friends who's going down to see this. You're going to want to boast about it by saying, look, I caught like a 3-minute clip of him doing it, and all of your friends are going to be like, wow, he was amazing for those 3 minutes, or as some of the reviews suggest, wow, he was shit for that 3 minutes. You spent 50 quid on that, pissed.
But I mean, you mentioned Jack White earlier, who's known as a purist in all sorts of senses, certainly in terms of the way he records and also in the way he actually puts out records in terms of format. Yeah. Don't these people have a point that there's actually something kind of pure about not recording everything, even in like the professional way that you say?
Yeah. But what I'm saying is that you'd stem the tide of that immediately if, you know, there was more availability of these things. People aren't going to bother to film concerts if they know that there's going to be something available straight afterwards, are they? Because what's the point? You know, you're not. It's the equivalent of you're not going to bother to record. Nobody bothers to record BBC shows anymore because they know it's going to be an iPlayer. It's that kind of thing. Do you know what I mean? Somebody's going to bother to record, say, something that might be on Comedy Central because they can't get it back. Once it's that time period is eloped, that's it. You know, they need to record it while it's going live. Stop bitching, for one thing. If you were fucking distracted by a red light, you need to go back to acting school. And that's really hard. What a dick. He's never going to listen to this, but if he did, you're meant to be Sherlock the shit out of that.
I mean, in, you know, 20 years time, you're a successful playwright and Cumberbatch comes up to you and says, oh, that thing you said 20 years ago, fuck you.
Yeah,
well, I'm gonna ruin your career, you're never right in this fucking town again. How do you respond?
Oh god. Well, no, but seriously, like a red light from a phone was what he bitched about. I mean, literally, like, if somebody was like actively tweeting, was like, this is shit or something like that, then yeah, fine, I understand that you get a bit upset. A red light, how does he even know that it was somebody's phone? Like, for all he knows, it was the glint of somebody's, like, sparkly dress. Or, I don't know, it was an exit light that bounced off the rim of somebody's glasses. Like, it could be anything. Why are you getting distracted by that?
All right, so what do you think about this Cumberbatch controversy, or non-controversy, as the case may be? Do you think that we should still be banning phones and cameras from our theatres? Do you think, as John thinks, that we need to democratise theatre a bit more and actually open up the channels through which it can be experienced? Send your thoughts in to all the usual places. I've already said them twice, so if you've forgotten them at this point, you know, there's no hope for you. And we'll be back next week, hopefully with some slightly more exotic news than was available this time round. Thanks very much for listening. I've been Jimmy.
I've been John.
Au revoir.
On another like acting note, he always plays geniuses. You're not a fucking genius if, like a dog, you're like, red light, oh my god, red light, gotta chase the red. What was I saying? Where am I doing Hamlet? Oh, I need to start the speech again. Red light, no, not red light. To be or not to be, to be or not to, red light.